Globally, Britain has two track system: a successful financial services sector on the one hand, but millions of people at home who cannot access basic financial services on the other. This is not me who is saying it, but Charles Randall, ex-chair of the Financial Conduct Authority and a member of the Financial Inclusion Commission. We also have a Labour government and Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, who just outlined her budget to the British public, which will hit the top 10% of the British population. But would the budget make any difference to millions of residents who are excluded from the financial services market? Or is this just another red herring? Welcome to Debt Talk Podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray. But you may have guessed it, but I'm speaking about financial exclusion and lending, since one in six families has no savings in the UK. So to guide me in this month's podcast, I have Fran Boyt, co-executive director of Positive Money, which campaigns for alternative financial system in the UK and make the banking sector more people-centered. I also have Shireena Ali, advice manager from Limehouse Project, which is a frontline charity that deals with marginalized communities which are struggling financially, including due to financial exclusion. My panel members are also to provide top tips for Debt Talk listeners in order to develop strategies to reduce financial exclusion near the end of the podcast. So let me get Fran from Positive Money to give us an overview of the current financial situation in the UK. Fran, former chair of the Financial Conduct Authority, emphasized that regardless of the UK being a shining example of the financial services sector, millions are still being missed out. Can you explain how bad is the UK when it comes to excluding communities from financial services, and what does he actually mean?
Thanks for having me on, Ripon. So financial exclusion takes several different forms. So in terms of the unbanked, so specifically people who don't have access to a bank account, there are 1.1 million unbanked, according to the Financial Conduct Authority. If we're talking more broadly about access to financial products and services, then the Financial Conduct Authority's recent survey found 23% of adults, that's about 12.1 million people, have had issues accessing a financial product or service in the 2 years prior to May 2022. And one of the biggest widespread kind of financial exclusion issues have been around branch closures. So banks and building societies have closed over 6,000 branches since January 2015 at a rate of around 53 a month. And that represents more than 62% of branches that were opened just under a decade ago. So that's had a massive knock-on impact. Now, one in seven of us relies on cash, and online banking isn't a viable option for many in the UK. Around 23% of people do not feel comfortable banking online. And there's almost 2 million people who are unable to afford internet access, and a further 9 million without the foundational skills to participate in a digital society. So using cash isn't, about one demographic. Preferences include a way to keep control of your own money. And at the same time, cash is a major lifeline for millions. So it does impact different communities, from migrants and refugees, the elderly, homeless, disabled, and those living in poverty. An important form of financial exclusion is the poverty premium, so the cost of being poor. And many of those who are already the poorest in society are forced into kind of expensive debt, which further worsens their economic position. So, as you mentioned, we have a huge number of people with what's called low financial resilience. So that jumped from about 3.5 million to 4.1 million during the pandemic of those having less than £100 in savings. And about 17.5 million people can now be considered financially vulnerable. Businesses also have financial exclusion, with 43% of businesses that have applied for finance in highly deprived areas being rejected. That was in 2019. And black and brown-led small and medium-sized businesses are also much less likely to get the finance they applied for. There's issues around individuals, households, and businesses, and there's a huge level of financial exclusion in the UK, which is one of the richest economies in the world.
What has been the driving force for such a disparity in British society today?
So we have a, as you mentioned in your opening, a very dysfunctional financial system. We have a handful of huge banks which dominate the banking system. Their only concern is maximizing short returns for their shareholders, and lending towards most profitable, low risk, loans, which is usually mortgages for wealthy people. We have a much less diverse financial system than other countries. So many other countries have a healthier ecosystem of public stakeholder banks, a more vibrant kind of mutual sector, CDFIs, credit unions. We have some stakeholder banks, some credit unions, some community development financial institutions, but they haven't been able to scale up. We see time after time governments and regulation prioritizing the interests of the big banks and kind of designing that to fit them primarily. And so it doesn't encourage the development of a more of an ecosystem. But it's also important to note that some of these impacts are not just driven by, financial regulation. Whilst we really need to think about how our financial system works, financial inclusion, it's not a kind of panacea to inequality. There's also things the government must be doing around, social security, investment in public services, housing, ensuring decent jobs. And I think we'll get into a bit more of that later on as well.
We have seen a recent development in technological advances, such as artificial intelligence, which are making dramatic changes in the lending market. Do you see that as a negative or a positive thing within the context of communities that are struggling?
Yes, so AI and algorithms often reflect society's existing biases and so exacerbate discrimination. And this is no different for financial services. So, a good example is the insurance sector. And I think research shows that people of colour spend on average £250 more than white people on car insurance, for example. And people in poor areas are hit by a postcode penalty. So they can pay more than £300 a year more than those living in richer areas. And it's believed that AI and algorithms for insurers use this for pricing. And so it exacerbates an issue. Though there is an issue with firms not publishing the data or the algorithms that they use. So we can't exactly see how they're kind of ending up with these pricing decisions. You can see the same biases and discrimination happening and being exacerbated in AI.
There is no doubt an obligation for lenders to make sure that they take due diligence by checking credit rating and so forth. There should be a system in place to checks and balance in place to make sure they do lend to those who are creditworthy.
Absolutely. And I think, partly because of this unusually undiverse banking sector I mentioned, which is kind of dominated by this small number of shareholder-owned large banks, then we get a worse situation where discrimination against those on low incomes and insecure work is a really significant issue. Now, this kind of shift happened in the kind of 1980s. The kind of big bang was the deregulation under Thatcher. And what happened was a lot of credit unions and mutuals disappeared, some merged. And we had this shift towards a few large shareholder-owned banks focusing less on lending to individuals, communities, kind of your relationship banking, if you like, and more on this credit scoring system done by algorithms, which are discriminatory against those on lower incomes. Obviously, there's an obligation for lenders to make sure they're lending those they're lending to can repay. But, there's no reason why we can think about how we can have more relationship banking again, where actually people rather than algorithms can better understand the borrower's position and how a bank can have a closer relationship with borrowers, for example. So, you know, if a borrower has previously taken out a payday loan in the past or has a poor credit hi history, but now is in a stable job, in the current system, they might be denied a loan through the bank's algorithm, even though they now have a stable job and could afford it. And so getting around these algorithms would require in-person services, but that obviously costs more. And we've seen banks striving to shut and close branches, which is why we need more kind of purpose-driven models in banks and in other financial institutions so that we can move towards a fairer system when it comes to lending. And have more of that kind of organic approach to risk where people have a conversation with the individual, local households or businesses and kind of decide how whether they'd be able to repay. But we've got the opposite in the UK happening. We've got branches closing, centralized algorithms, and as we've discussed, this exacerbates inequalities. And it's basically a market failure. You know, there's this information asymmetry. We've tried to fix it with loan guarantees that enable lenders to turn no's into yeses, community development, financial institutions, CDFIs have been able to make some good use of these schemes, but limited resources and uncertainty over funding has held back their impact.
Back to credit reports that we talked about, you talked about briefly, and the purpose of credit report. What is the purpose of credit report? And is it just for creditors to check or ways for reference agencies to buy and sell data for companies to target?
Both, I guess, is the answer. So, credit scoring is a method of assessing the risk attached to a borrower. So, banks offer those with poor credit ratings less favorable terms due to the higher perceived risk of default. So, those with poorer credit ratings will get offered loans with much higher interest. But it's not done in a fair or unbiased way, as we've discussed. So we have inbuilt basic biases based on race, class, geographical location. But banks, they always, you know, will give better conditions, lower interest rates to wealthier clients, and they'll see those as more profitable. So it turns into a very unfair and biased system, which exacerbates inequality. Even before the pandemic, over 10 million people could not afford. Could not access affordable credit. So they were forcing people to turn to very high cost credit providers, such as payday lenders, whose interest rates can be over 1,000%.
If we remember during the financial crisis that resulted from lending to communities who are unable to pay their debt, if you remember the ninja concept that came out. So do we mean that approach that we should be taking to remove exclusion, or what other means are we talking about?
You know, in the run-up to the financial crash, banks were selling credit that was really exploitative. And we know the culture in some banks and financial institutions were really aggressive. So people were ending up with loans they couldn't repay because of aggressive marketing. And as you mentioned, ninja loans, so ninja stands for no income, no job or assets, were really exploitative, targeting people who were economically vulnerable and pushing them into more expensive debt. Like most lenders, which have reasonable interest rates, saying no and declining people's application does worsen poverty as it pushes people towards high interest or even illegal lending. And high cost credit products were being used, as I mentioned, by like over 3 million people before the pandemic. And estimates suggest more than 1 million people are borrowing from an illegal money lender, so 2.4% of all households. You know, one approach to the issue of people being able to access affordable credit could be the increasing availability and consistency of loan guarantee schemes for credit unions, which can help them turn a no into a yes. And I think it's important to also think about the wider situation of what the state is doing. So it's not all around moving people from high cost credit to the mainstream banks. It's also about looking at poverty in the first place, ensuring that there's a strong safety net through all for all through social security, looking at the inequalities built into our economy. We need to kind of think about making and receiving payments like getting access to water and electricity. They're kind of utilities that everyone needs in their day-to-day lives. So ensuring that those who have lower le levels of income and wealth aren't subject to a poverty premium, which increases the cost.
Positive money campaigns for fairer finances. How would fairness in the financial sector help communities who are currently excluded from the financial services?
Yeah, so we look at the kind of whole financial and economic system, how it drives inequality. So part of our work is advocating for better equality in financial services and regulation, making sure that financial inclusion is considered when we look at different parts of the system. And as I've mentioned, we have this very concentrated banking system. So we have five big banks, which really reduce the ability to develop an ecosystem of financial services, so more credit unions, public development banks, and the public payment system. And so we need to kind of ensure that people aren't pushed into high cost credit. And so it goes kind of hand in hand with a healthy economy at large. So bringing inequality down, providing people with a decent security net, housing, decent jobs, etc. And making sure we rewire the financial system and regulate it for people and not just for serving the banks.
I'm sure you have been following Rachel Reeves' announcement that her budget targets the top 10% of the taxpayers. But does that help those communities who are financially already struggling and are excluded?
So, as mentioned, yeah, financial exclusion kind of goes hand in hand with poverty. So, if we're looking at whether communities who have been excluded will be better off, that's a different question from whether they'll be able to access financial services. And looking at in terms of which levels of society were targeted by the budget, it's a mixed bag. The budget saw some welcome increases in taxes on the wealthiest, like increasing the rate of capital gains tax. Tax on assets like second homes or company shares when they are sold. But it didn't go very far in terms of equalising this with taxation on income from work or to introduce more direct taxation on wealth, which we know is hugely unequal in the UK and a huge driver of inequality due to the ability to use wealth and assets to derive further income once you kind of have it. So, you know, there were some pieces of good news. An increase in the minimum wage will help those on lower pay. A lack of new money for social security spending, alongside an increase in cost of living, with social rent rises announced and a recent lifting of the energy price cap, means that the budget, from a distributional perspective, wasn't very progressive. And we know that, you know, things like the two-child benefit cap are putting huge numbers of children into poverty. And if they lifted that, almost immediately, 500,000 children would be lifted out of absolute poverty. So there was a lot more they could have done.
Knowing that there are long-term and short-term strategies and plans, what do you want to see happen, or what do you want to see implemented from the current government to remove exclusion in our communities?
Keyword area that we've been working on is the design of a digital pound, which would be a new form of publicly issued money, like a digital bank note. So it would allow anyone to have access to risk-free money in a digital form without needing a bank account. And it in itself could allow for more inclusive access to cheaper payments. We've been pushing the Treasury and the Bank of England about the need for a more ambitious approach. So there is a real opportunity here to address financial exclusion with a new public payment system, but not one they're currently embracing. Our proposal would suggest that we could have the post office, for example, as a public institution offering inclusive in-person access to digital and physical cash with banking hubs, which would be you know, a counter action as banks continue to close their branches in communities across the country. And as mentioned, it's not financial exclusion is not just felt by households, but also businesses, particularly small ones, get a really poor deal for basic banking services. So again, with a digital pound, there could be an opportunity for businesses to have access to cheaper or even free digital pound accounts, to safely hold funds and make payments. And this could be connected to, better lending models, as we've talked about, or as I've talked about a little bit. We really need a more diverse financial system, a bigger role for public and stakeholder lenders such as credit unions, mutuals, and other community development financial institutions as alternatives to the big shareholder-owned banks. Labour have said that they'll aim to double the size of the mutual sector in the UK and develop a national financial inclusion strategy. Both are very welcome, but we also want them to make sure that they're thinking about these things in a joined-up way that looks at our financial system holistically. So we've argued that the government's new National Wealth Fund could help promote this by on-lending funds or providing more guarantees to purpose-driven lenders. Unfortunately, so far it's prioritised subsidising the big shareholder banks such as Barclays and Lloyds, which we feel like is missing a huge opportunity to support better banking models. All of these moves to think about the financial system and how it can become more inclusive need to be supported by wider progressive economic policies that tackle wealth inequality and provide a solid social security net.
Thank you, Fran from Positive Money. Let me get Sharina Ali from Limehouse Project into the conversation. Sharina, you directly help communities who are struggling financially. Do you think Rachel Reeves' budget would help financially excluded communities that you serve at all, or is it just a red herring?
There were good and bad things when we knew the budget wasn't going to be groundbreaking in any way, but at the same time, we were thinking it's a Labour budget, so we were quite hopeful that it will mean positive things for my community. However, things like the rise in the minimum income, that was very welcomed by certain groups in our community. However, it also means that other community members, other clients who are reliant on possibly universal credit or housing benefit, a rise in minimum income wages means that the benefits will reduce or they will have to pay more personal tax. So in this current climate, when we're going through a cost of living crisis, when we've got rising rents and bills and things like that, it's not enough. It just doesn't go far enough. And so we were it wasn't as positive as we thought it was going to be. It puts employers in a very difficult position because their taxes have risen and they have to now make very tough decisions about who they will let go. We've already had people come in and say they have to look for new jobs because their employers already warned them that they may not be employed by the end of this year. Choices are being made and they're very tough choices, and the community is now going to be at the up well, my Tower Hamlets community will be at the brunt of that budget.
What is it that you're seeking that has been the main cause of financial exclusion in the communities that you serve, such as the Bangladeshi communities and the Somalian communities in the East End?
We need a system that supports our clients. Our clients are mostly, they don't speak English as a second, they speak English as a second language, sometimes no English at all. They have very low literacy rates, they have very low numeracy rates. A lot of the majority of the banking industry has now moved online. So if I wanted personally to go look for a savings account, I could go online and find that information. I could actually access a lot of these bank accounts and maybe open, positively actually get to the end and open an account at the end of it and be offered those interest rates. My community doesn't know how to do that. They don't know how to access digital formats in the banks. They don't know how to open bank accounts. And funny enough, before I came on this, I was thinking about bank and branch closures, Fran. On the main road in Tower Hamlets from Commercial Road, starting at Aldgate and going all the way to Poplar, there isn't actually a branch that my clients can go into and seek help. There isn't. They've closed down the two main banks that. The large banks that we all know about, they've closed their branches. And the only support they can get financially is two post office from one end of Commercial Road to the other end. So that's a lot of, like, if someone wanted to wake up and seek financial support in any way or put money in a bank, they'd have to pay over £1 to get on a bus to get to that post office, put that money in, and come back. People don't have that kind of money. So we really don't think a lot of these changes that the banks have made are in the interest of my clients or my community.
How can maintenance can improve accessibility for vulnerable communities?
Because of my work through financial education over the last couple of years, we know our clients are not changing the way they bank or the way they learn because they simply don't know. They don't know how to bank. They simply don't know. No one has actually explained to them how it all works. Through our financial education sessions, we talk about compound interest. We talk about how to open a savings account, what kind of documents you need. But those are very personal one-to-one sessions. They are not, that information isn't out there in the mainstream. People don't go into these communities and explain how all of this works. There's a massive mistrust in all of this. We constantly hear in the news how one bank is collapsing or the interest rate is too high or someone can't afford to pay their mortgage. And it really scares the community into accessing a lot of these financial products. Also savings, this lack of branches means that people cannot go in and put the money into a savings account. Where else are they supposed to go? We've had people who take out large sums of money from when they've received the benefit or their wages because they can't afford to keep going out to ATMs and get that money out. So now they're vulnerable with large sums of money. It's crazy that we've gone back to this system because we were supposed to get away from this system. And it is because a lot of that community in Tower Hamlets, they are cash led. Their jobs are cash led as well. They rely on cash quite heavily. Their money that they can, their food that they can afford is usually not in Sainsbury's and Iceland. It's usually in the market, and the market doesn't take card. The market doesn't take Apple Pay and things like that. So the entire community is based around cash. But then, where do they get the cash from? There isn't access to this cash as well. So it's like we've gone back to the 70s and the 80s, how my dad used to carry his cash in his back pocket. It shouldn't have been, it shouldn't be like this, but we keep going backwards.
So would it help communities if there was alternative lending and borrowing, such as credit unions and other similar types of service providers when it comes to providing services?
It would definitely help because we know credit union does amazing work and they for the community. They have cheaper interest rates. They have better lending options, things like that. However, if I was to go out and ask my community, do you know what a credit union is? Do you know where it is? I don't think any of them will be able to answer that question. I know my local one has closed down, so I hardly ever see the front door open. I think what we need is education. I don't think anytime soon someone's going to come out and say, here's a bank for that community. We need education. We need a lot of people working in the ground to, be having accessible information, easy to read information that a 5-year-old might be able to understand because with the lack of, jargon, we'd be able to make things a lot clearer. Even when I get my little debit card or my credit card upgrades or whatever, they send a piece of paper where the writing is this small. I mean, who reads that? Nobody understands how credit cards work. They just know I borrowed the money, I'll pay it off. They end up paying far more interest than the actual purchase price of the item they paid for because they don't know how the interest works. They just know that it's a credit card and the money's not theirs. So it's things like that we really need to invest in. We need to invest in more community programs. We need to invest in paperwork that's in the community language. We need to open up branches, but I don't know how realistic that is. I'm really surprised this was done in Tower Hamlets when they knew many of the people around those branches needed access, physical access to branches. So I'm really surprised these branches have closed down.
But is there a genuine lack of money in the community that results in financial exclusion, or is there anything else that you can think of?
There is a lack of money. The cost of living crisis hit our communities quite high. The budget has revealed that Miss Reeves would like social rent to go up, which affects my community because the majority of them are in social housing or private housing. So if rents do rise, no one's wages are going to rise at the same time. So there will be a massive difference in how much people can pay for these. We know that social housing in Tower Hamlets have also gone up by about 20%. So it's crazy when we're thinking about the amount of money that people receive, either from benefits or wages, to how much then their expenses are. We always, even me, I have to go into a shop, buy a bag of food, and I walk away thinking, how did that cost me £35? You know, it's just a bag of food. And it's funny that these conversations we're having again and again about the cost of simple items like milk, bread, eggs, you know, daily expenses that we paid for before that didn't cost us an arm and a leg is now costing us an arm and a leg. So the lack of money is definitely contributing to a financial exclusion for many of my clients. But it's all the other things that they can't access. You know, if they could access good savings accounts, if they could access help with good credit loans and things like that, maybe they'd be able to support themselves a bit more. But they don't have access to a lot of these things. They wouldn't even know where to go to begin to even learn about them.
To sum it up, what do we need to improve between the relation between the lender and the borrower?
Last year, we worked with a very well-known bank. And they came to our services and they spoke to about 20 of our clients, and our clients were able to put across some of their needs, what they wanted, some of the changes they wanted. It started off with a lot of miscommunication. Like they didn't know what the banks were doing, they didn't understand what their role was. And what our clients really wanted was a safe option, like a safe option for them to like access. And they didn't feel that the mainstream banks offered them that. They felt like they couldn't open a bank and bank as well as other people. They didn't trust a lot of the interest rates or the hidden charges. It's basically what we're asking is clarity. We need someone to explain how all of this works. We need communication that's simpler. And yes, many more of these focus groups. We talk about the grapevine, you know, the grapevine gossip aunties that we have. A lot of our community members would rather ask their next door neighbors or their friends what they think a bank is, or what their, you know, or what this product is, or what a credit card is. They won't go to a professional. Whereas if I wanted that advice, I would then go on the internet and I would ask a professional, you know, what is a mortgage broker? What do they do? That I would know how to access that information. A lot of my clients don't have that access information. So they will ask their aunties, they will ask their next door neighbors, they will get a whole bunch of, oh, my uncle's son had some kind of weird interaction and they took all his money. Don't do it, just don't do it, and things like that. So we cannot have that. We cannot have this cycle of grapevine gossip going on. And we try and break down a lot of those myths in our organization. We try and have really good, solid websites that they can go to and access information. But those are only for people who come to us and want to learn more. I'll sit down with, I'll take that time and I'll explain everything to them, how I think this is how it works. But it's only for people who come to us.
Thank you, Sharina. For those who are listening to Debt Talk podcast and want to share your experience, or you want to listen to a subject that is pressing to you, you can get in touch with me on X at Your Doctor Debt, or email me ripon.ray@yourdoctordebt.com. Let me return to my panel members to provide Debt Talk listeners with top tips to assist decision makers and campaigners in formulating policies to reduce exclusion within the lending set. Let me start with Fran from Positive Money.
For me, it's got to be directed at the decision makers. And I think the starting point is to really engage with financial exclusion. Like it would be great to get some decision makers to work with some of the people that Sharina's been working with, at least hear from them. Something we've been pushing is in the development of a digital pound, a big part of the Bank of England and Treasury strategy is a national conversation. And we really want that to be meaningful because there is an opportunity here to build a new public payments platform, which could be financially inclusive and could really provide people with a safe place to store their money and make payments, which is obviously the basics of financial services. And we really want to encourage them to talk to people. Different groups have, you know, vastly different experiences with our unequal and unfair financial system. And this is a real opportunity. So maybe I'll leave it at that and focus on the national conversation of a digital pound as a potential positive way forward.
And finally, Sharina from Limehouse Project.
I think for me, we need financial education classes aimed at the community, and those need to be provided by these organizations that provide these products. They need to communicate how they are supporting communities positively. And those messages need to come from them.
I'm very grateful to my panel members for giving their precious time from their busy schedule. Debt Talk did approach mainstream lenders such as Lloyds and Barclays. We still wait to hear from them. However, my next podcast is going to be on hidden worries during Christmas. Thank you for listening to the Debt Talk podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray.